In the FCRA, Congress struck a balance between...
Before we get underway into these next three cases, I'm interested in how many more of them there are. Murray against HSBC Auto Finance was argued to another panel on the 1st of November. Correct. How many more similar cases are before the Court of Appeals now?
I believe at most from my firm one more. Actually, there's one involving IndyMac, which I still think is in the circuit settlement conference, and briefing has not started.
Any case other than HSBC Auto Finance? I don't want to call it the Murray case because there are 50 Murray cases.
Yes, there has been one other that has been argued. And that was...
But you can tell us on rebuttal. Perhaps...
There's been
be
two that have been argued in there. Yes.
Perhaps it would be a good idea for you to file a supplemental letter after argument telling us the status on appeal of other similar cases, because we're going to need to coordinate across panels. We've now got at least two, maybe three panels looking at this subject, and that's not a prudent use of appellate resources.
Fine.
All right. Please proceed.
So. The benefit to the creditors is that they are able to narrow their solicitations to persons who are probably more interested in the credit product than the general public. However, in order for creditors to use credit material to send pre-screened solicitations, the mailer must be a firm offer of credit that gives value to the consumer. The Federal Reserve Board, in its 2004 report to Congress on pre-screened mailers, discussed this balance of benefits and value regarding firm offers of credit. It found that the benefit, the value to the consumer from pre-screening, was enhanced competition, which was effectuated because the mailer, quote, contains pricing information in a form easily comparable to accounts currently held, end of quote.
But I wanted to offer a couple of thoughts here. One of them is, yes, you know, we've seen that Federal Reserve report. It's kind of a policy discussion about why might Congress have struck the balance that it did strike between the ability to solicit and when one had to hold back. But it strikes me that there are a couple of broad issues here. One of them is, what's the right way to read this court's decision in Cole? There's one way to read it in which one would say you can't make it look like you're offering credit, but it's actually just a sham, you know, $300 for a whole automobile and in this joint kind of thing. Another way to read Cole, which has been rejected by a couple of panels at this point, but maybe only partially, I don't want to close the door, is as in grafting upon the FCRA certain disclosure requirements, and that if say the amount of the credit and the interest rate and the way payment is to be received and different factors like that, if they're not laid out, then it's automatically not a firm offer. And, you know, all the banks are coming in and saying, no, you know, TILA is the disclosure statute, not the FCRA. But there are really some overarching issues here as to what that firm offer language is, what we ought to look at, whether we need to look at just the solicitation, and if it's like the one that your client got here, Mr. Bruce, and they really were willing to offer him some credit, that's enough. You know, there's some very broad issues that cut across these cases.
Okay, let me start with Cole. I think that a fair reading of Cole is that the terms of the offer, which is what gives value to the consumer, should be in the mailer itself. It certainly said...
And what was the statutory basis for that? I mean, the statute defines firm offer of credit, and we've been looking at that in these recent weeks as all of these cases have been coming before the court. I know the discussion in Cole you're talking about, but can you offer some kind of statutory grounding for it?
Well, the statutory definition is an offer of credit to a consumer that will be honored. As the court in Cole made very clear, that the honoring element is not dispositive. I think that what Cole went to when it talked about the terms, where they were looking at what is it that the creditor has to honor. And without some of the pricing information, and particularly the APR and the amount of the loan, you don't know what the creditor says, I will honor if you accept. In Cole itself, it refers in many places to the offer being in the mailer, and it talks about the terms that are in that offer. It talks about the vagueness of some of the terms. They put in an APR from, I believe, 3% to 25%, and they said that wasn't good enough, but that was in the mailer, and it wasn't good enough. And then they listed terms that were not in the mailer. And actually, I do believe that the three subsequent firm offer of credit cases this court has decided have all affirmed Cole on that basis. In Perry, which was a credit card case, and they ruled there was a firm offer of credit, they distinguished Cole, explicitly saying that Cole held that one of the things that indicated that it was not a firm offer of credit was if there is not the pricing information in it. It was a clear affirmance of that. In Murray, the court talking about firm offers of credit again affirmed Cole and said in determining whether or not a firm offer of credit has been made, you look to the four corners of the mailer. Four corners is not something that is used to describe a telephone conversation after somebody applies. It concerns the document, and it is the mailer, which is what Congress is allowing the creditors to make without having a transaction initiated by the consumer.
But that generation of the Murray cases didn't really say the only thing you look at is the four corners. I know it uses that language, but the rest of the statutory scheme remains in place. I mean, the offer has to get the ball rolling, but the statutory scheme itself recognizes that it's functionally a contingent firm offer, if you can say that. You know, you do have the right to make sure that the person that you thought was pre-qualified still meets those criteria.
Well, Murray also refers to the terms of the offer and states to decide whether the defendant has adhered to the statute, a court need only determine whether the four corners of the offer satisfy the definition. And they have previously, preceding paragraph, referred to the terms of the offer. I believe that all four of the cases from this court has indicated that the terms should be in there, because this court consistently talks about giving value.
Counsel, where? I've read these opinions. I can't see anything in them that says all terms must be in the offer, as if the letter were the Truth in Lending Act disclosure.
No, not material terms is what has been said, and they have particularly focused on the amount of credit.
I ask this question because you just asserted that all four of this court's relevant cases had said that.
Right.
And I've said I've read them. I can't find where they say that. So where do they say that?
I will backtrack from all material, but in Cole, as I've just indicated, it talks about what is in the terms of the offer and finds compliance problems with the fact that the terms have are not in there, the material terms, and the wide spread of the APR that is given. In Murray, is directed to look to what terms have been extended and then talks about the four corners of the offer. Perry talks about, and this is a quote from it, in Cole, we identified three factors supporting the appellant's argument that the defendant's solicitation was a firm offer. Second was the precise rate of credit and other material terms were not included in the solicitation. I don't think you can get more explicit than that.
I can think of lots of ways.
What can be left out, Mr. Letchin?
Pardon?
What could you say could be left out?
There are perhaps... Let me express on what I really believe has to be in there, which was identified in Cole. The APR, the amount of credit, the length of the credit, and in some instances, how the interest is computed.
There can be a range on the APR. You would acknowledge that?
No. Cole criticized using a range of the APR. Cole was 3 to 25%. The KeyBank mailer here is 5 to 25%.
Any of the answers you're giving based even remotely on the statute, or are you just urging us to give a broad reading to an opinion? Now, the opinion is not the statute. What is it in the statute that you think requires these things?
I think the statute is giving permission to creditors to use credit material to send solicitations.
No, your answer has to be a citation to a provision in a statute.
I would go to that it is something that has to be honored, and in order to have something to be honored, you have to know what it is. And I think that I do not believe I'm suggesting a broad reading four cases from this court.
You haven't so far cited any provision of the statute. Right? The question I asked invited you to cite a part of the statute. There has to be some section of the statute you're relying on, and we can then discuss what it means.
Part of the statute that Cole relied on was the definition.
I'm not
the
asking
definitional
about
section?
Cole. I'm asking about you.
Definitional section, and based upon that definitional section, they move.
What definitional section? Could you give me a citation? You must have some concrete language in mind. I'm then go look it up.
I can find it within the case. The statute requires that an offer of credit be honored in order to qualify as a firm offer of credit. The term firm offer of credit or insurance means any offer or...
Excuse me.
Yes.
Can you give me a citation that I can then go and look up? And then we can discuss what the language of the statute means. I don't want an impression of the statute.
No, I was actually quoting at that time, and in the appendix, it is at the very bottom of the right-hand column of Appendix 2.
Give me a citation.
Cole.
No, Cole is not a statute.
The citation of the statute.
Yes.
15 U.S.C.
Clear.
15 U.S.C. 1681A1.
1681A1. All right. I will go look it up.
And I believe that I'm into rebuttal time. I would just like to simply say that on the issue of willfulness, the court determined the case on a standard that has been effectively overruled by Safeco. Under Safeco, and after this court's opinion in Cole and the FRB report, and actually the position taken by the FTC in its brief in Cole, that their failure to include the interest rate and, in fact, putting in a range of interest that was almost identical to that in Cole was willful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Gottlieb.
May it please the court, Richard Gottlieb for the Appellee Key Bank. I would like to start by answering Judge Easterbrook's question, where in the statute? The answer is nowhere in the statute.
Well,
the statute nowhere requires.
I was beginning to wonder whether it was nowhere, but he ultimately did cite a statute. My question was, what statute are you relying on?
I
assume he's now telling. I have no reason to disbelieve his statement that that's the section of the statute he's relying on.
I believe counsel was not citing to 1681A1. He was citing to probably 1681AL1, which is the any offer provision. But nowhere in that definition of firm offer.
He said 1681A1, and I'm trying to find it. Yeah.
But
you won't find it.
So that we don't spin our wheels. I believe he can correct me at some point if I'm wrong, perhaps, but or maybe not. The statute, and we had some discussion about this in an earlier argument on a different day.
You're right. There is no such statute.
A definition of firm offer of credit, and it is my understanding from reading these many briefs that the proponents of, let's say, a broad reading of Cole say that this all is a way of understanding what those words in the definition of firm offer of credit must mean. It can't be a firm offer of credit, for example, if you can say we will give you this offer unless we're in a bad mood that day. You know, it strikes me that there are all sorts of things. So the words firm offer of credit have to have some meaning behind them. And then the question becomes, how specific is the content that you put into that? You know, how much can you do in construing those words?
I think Your Honor is correct. I think the Cole case can completely be harmonized with the statute, because what Cole said, remember, Cole, the Murray case, the Perry case, and the Forrest case were all decided before summary judgment. Three of the four were decided on the pleadings. Cole, Perry, and Forrest were decided on the pleadings. The Murray case was decided on an interlocutory appeal over a class certification decision. None of those cases have the benefit of a full record, but Cole directed the...
I'm now totally lost. I cannot imagine what a record in a given case has to do with the meaning of the statute.
Well, and you know what, Your Honor, that's exactly right. What Cole said was to examine what a firm offer of credit is. We can't tell whether this particular mailer was a sham offer or not a sham offer. And so it directed on remand for the district court to look at the entire offer and the effect of all of the material conditions that comprise the credit product in question, and then said, if after examining the entire context you determine this was just a guise for solicitation, then you cannot find that this is a firm offer. And that is entirely consistent with the statute.
So how can we that strikes me as a very anti-summary judgment sort of rule, if you've got to go and have a lot of discovery about how often do banks, in fact, write loans based on these letters, and how do consumers interpret them, and do they really understand that they need to provide collateral, whatever. I mean, there are all kinds of questions that could come up. It seems to me if one way that you could avoid that would be extremely specific in the letter that you send to people. This is the interest rate. You know, we've pre-screened you. You know, we used criteria. You know, pull the files of everybody, you know, with credit scores higher than 700 or whatever.
Your Honor, Congress knows how to right disclosure provisions. You've already heard. You heard it in HSBC
Auto. I understand that, but Congress also wrote firm offer of credit. So Congress didn't mean unfirm offer of credit.
And I agree.
There has
However,
to be some meaning.
Well, actually, firm offer, you have to look back at the legislative history behind it. When
some members of this panel don't like legislative history.
some members of this panel, at least one, would like to start with the statute.
Well, I believe the statute is clear, but firm offer was in the original.
Mr. Gottlieb, you told me entirely accurately that Mr. LaTurner had referred me, after a long filibuster, to a non-existent statute. What statute would you like me to read?
I'd like you to read several provisions that relate to permissible purpose and relate to firm offers. The first one is the definition. The definition is any offer of credit.
And
that will
where
be
is it?
That
would
is
somebody cite the statute.
15 U.S.C. section 1681A, not parent A.
Yes.
L1. 1681A, paren L, paren 1. The term firm offer of credit or insurance means any offer of credit or insurance to a consumer that will be honored if the consumer is determined, dot, dot, dot. Okay? That's your baseline definition of firm offer. Nothing in there about material terms. Are there provisions where Congress set forth requirements to make disclosures with firm offers? Yes, there are. And those are contained in two places, Section 15 U.S.C. 1681MD.
Could you try this again?
Yeah.
1681A,
sub A,
yes.
Paren L.
Paren what?
Paren 1.
There are a whole bunch of things under 1, and 1 begins, the consumer being determined based on information. It's not a definitional section.
Well, actually, AL is the definitional section, then it follows with 1. So you start with AL1, AL2, and AL3. So just look at AL for the baseline definition.
Right. So you don't want me to go to 1?
No, just AL.
If you start with AL, you're there.
All right.
Okay, so answering that question, that's your baseline definition of firm offer. There are other places where Congress has identified disclosures. One of them is in AL3. If the mailer is going to address if there is a collateral requirement, then the offeror must disclose that there is a collateral requirement in the offer. Secondly, in 1681MD, there are disclosure requirements that relate to the nature of pre-screening and the right to opt out. Now, under basic principles of inclusio unius, one can infer from these provisions that you do not have a disclosure obligation with respect to terms if you want to refer strictly to the statute.
All right. I'm perfectly happy to refer strictly to the statute. And I can see something that says will be honored. All right. Now, your letter in this case says, if I can find the language, quote, actual rates, fees, and terms are based on those offered as of the date of the application and are subject to change without notice, close quote. How is that a firm offer?
Well,
it doesn't look like something the consumer can accept. It looks like something where if the consumer says, I accept, the seller can say, well, you know, the terms have changed. It's like the greased flagpole case that everybody studies in their first day of contracts class, where the offeree gets up to the top of the greased flagpole and the offeror says, revoked.
Well, I think if we had this case on a pleadings motion without the benefit of a full evidentiary record, then maybe this would have been something. Maybe if we had moved to dismiss, the case had been granted on the basis of that.
Look, forget about this. I'm trying to figure out the meaning of the statute as applied to the document that your client sent. The document your client sent appears to say, we are not offering anything. We reserve the right to change all the terms without notice. You have no firm offer that you're entitled to accept. That's what that statement says in normal English.
Your Honor, and if the statute required all the terms in the mailer...
No, look.
And it doesn't.
Counsel, just listen to my question. I'm not asking whether all the terms have to be there. The question I'm asking is, what is the significance of a phrase that says, not even the terms we've included are binding. Indeed, we reserve the right to change all the terms any time we want. How is that a firm offer?
It's a firm offer because examining the entire context. Let's go back to Cole for a second.
No, could we just stick with this question?
Sure, sure.
A firm, no. The word firm to the layperson means you aren't going to change it. Maybe you say you have 30 days to accept or something. We don't have to go to all eternity, but firm and we can change any time, any minute we want don't seem to be the same thing.
The reason why the can I cite to the evidentiary record in answering that?
No,
because that's the answer to the question.
Because just because in the past you might have stuck with these sort of vague statements, you might get $10,000 for as little as $58 a month, but on the other hand, you might get $10,000 for $700 a month. I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't see anything in this letter. This is all in the. You could get this. You may be approved for that. And then we're subject to change without notice in the little print on page two.
I think to give you the answer that I think you're looking for. If you're looking just at the mailer, and you're not looking beyond the mailer.
And you're the one who wanted us to stick with the four corners.
I did not. In fact, I don't believe four corners is the analysis at all. In fact, what Judge Easterbrook's opinion said in Murray versus GMAC Mortgage was look at the four corners of the offer, not four corners of the mailer, which was Mr. LeTourneur's expression of the quote. It's four corners of the offer. The way we read the statute, the statute speaks to the transaction. It does so in three different locations, speaking to the transaction. It actually distinguishes statutorily between the transaction and the initial mailer. And where does it do that? It does that in 1681 MD, where it refers to a situation where if the transaction is commenced...
I'm now lost. Normal part of contract law is that an offer is something to which the other side can say, I accept, and a contract will be formed. It's perfectly conceivable that you can have an offer with terms that are not disclosed. You can have an offer that says, I will sell you three boxcars of widgets on my standard form contract. You don't have to disclose a standard form contract, and somebody can say, I accept, ship the widgets. But this sounds like it's not something to which anyone can say, I accept, because no term is knowable. Right? It's as if somebody said, I will sell you an amount of what may be widgets, what may be gidgets, it may be three, it may be six, and oh, by the way, I won't tell you the price. No one can say, I accept to such a thing.
Well, let me refer to the statute again, because we don't appear to want to go to the evidentiary record. The statute says any offer that will be honored. And the Cole court said, we've got to remand.
What I'm asking is whether this is an offer.
Yes,
within the normal meaning of contract law.
Your Honor, in Cole, in footnote 6, the court rejected the concept.
I'm asking about Cole.
Okay. Statutorily.
To answer any further question by saying Cole says
okay. He
will be shot.
I'd like to remain alive, so I will answer the question. You don't have any electrical devices on this, do you? I hope not.
Judge Easterbrook has been known to threaten to put a Jabba the Hutt shoot, though, by the by the podium.
Well, I didn't think we would use the word pellucid twice in one argument.
One of my brothers once gave me a Star Trek phaser to pull out and fire, but I didn't bring it with me today.
Could you restate the question for me? I'm sorry.
I'm looking at your – this is in actually the appendix to – the plaintiff's brief, page A11, A12, which, as I understand it, is the letter that Mr. Bruce got. And I can see that it's called an offer in the PS line, but I'm not sure otherwise what they're doing other than saying, if you phone us, maybe we will offer you something.
The reference to pre-selected or pre-approved is contained above that. In the line it says, call 1-800-CHAMPION. It then says, we've pre-selected you for a home equity line of credit with a minimum amount of $10,000. In the Kennedy case, the court said that pre-selected and pre-approved are synonymous. In the Perry case, the first factor in satisfying the Cole test was saying, we're pre-approved. And
but your problem is, at least the problem I've been asking about, is that the next page says, we reserve the right to change all terms, and one of the all terms is $10,000. Could be that you've been approved for $2.98, or we're not approving anybody for more than $2.98, because we reserve the right to change all terms.
My time is up. May I answer the question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This was a variable rate product loan. To make the disclosure meaningful, the Truth in Lending Act and the FTC require that on variable rate products, you disclose that the rates are subject to change. The O'Leary testimony in the plaintiff's brief points out that the language was placed in there, and O'Leary was the compliance officer, to address the fact that it was a variable rate product. The prime rates do fluctuate. That's why it's in there. The plaintiff did not elicit a single piece of evidence that this disclosure was ever used to bait and switch any terms. And, in fact, there's testimony in the record from Chris Mano, who was one of the marketing personnel, that literally loan offers were not even authorized to make any changes. So the actual record shows that there were no changes.
Scully, with the Chief Judge Easterbrook's permission, I just want to ask you a question and go back to the statute. On AL, on the firm offer of credit, is it your position that the language of disclosure of actual rates, fees, terms based on those offered on the date of application are subject to change without notice, what we've been talking about, is that cabined at all by based on the language, based on information in a consumer report on the consumer? In other words, is that your position that you are bound if the report comes back within whatever the favorable range is to grant it?
I understand your question.
Because if you have a total escape, then I don't know how that language is honored in the statute based on information in the consumer report on that consumer.
Well, this is not a total escape. This is a situation where we're not saying the offer is going to be rescinded. For example, contrast this with the Cole language where the solicitation said that the offer is neither guaranteed nor whatever.
Right.
That's not what happens here. This is not saying we're going to withdraw the offer. We may change certain rates and terms.
Yeah,
that's a different analysis from not being guaranteed at all.
Yeah, and I like my sister and brother, just want to leave Cole aside for just a second. I just want to go to the statute. And I want to, as best I can, under the definition of firm offer of credit, as we must accept that definition, we're compelled to accept it, it does have this qualifier in it, which makes it, one could argue, a soft firm offer or a firm firm offer, whatever. But I want your read on that phrasing based on an information in a consumer report on the consumer. What does that say? Is it language of limitation at all to the credit offerer?
I think it is. There's actually two key conditions placed in Section 1681A. One is that section where you can go back and base it on what's in the person's credit report. Another one is that you can go beyond the credit report to gather information that isn't available in the credit report. So it's a verification, and then it's also a supplemental allowance to go beyond what's in the credit report. For example, one does not know the value of the house. This is a mortgage transaction. One doesn't know the value of the house. One doesn't know the debt-to-income ratio because you don't know the person's actual income. One doesn't know whether what the loan-to-value is when you total up all those information. And this particular offer, it had an 85% LTV, loan-to-value requirement. Can't know that from a pre-screening. You've got to verify
I appreciate you need the verification. Right. I'm just saying, why has Congress put that language in there? And who does it speak to?
Well, I don't want to get zapped for referring to legislative history
but
there is an answer to that question from the legislative history. In the Senate report in the time period of 1996 when this was adopted, there's a reference that Congress recognized that there was a need in many of these pre-screening situations to go beyond what was in the pre-screening information, and that's why they needed to condition it. And in fact, in Kennedy versus Chase Manhattan Bank, the court said firm offer really means a firm offer if you meet these conditions.
Isn't that your position, then? That's what you want us to read, firm offer. It's a firm offer if you meet these conditions.
That's exactly what Kennedy versus Chase Manhattan Bank says. Thank you. My time is up.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Leiter.
First, I apologize. I read a small L as I won in giving the citation. Term offer is not defined in the statute, and therefore it will carry the common law, contract law meaning, which requires something concrete that can be honored.
So if this letter didn't have that sentence that Judge Easterbrook was talking about, actual rates, fees, and terms are based on those offered as of the date and subject to change without notice, you still don't think it would be good enough?
I still don't think it would be good enough, but certainly the get-out-of-jail-free card on this is a second reason for not finding it. And with regard to the conditions,
of course, all terms means is the fine print, like is the payment due on the last day of the month or the first day of the month? That's an ambiguity that I suppose could be resolved by evidence of actual conduct. If terms means do you get $10,000 or 2 cents, I assume that would be material. But if it's just the fine print, then there's no worry.
It is also material on whether you get 5% or 25%. If offer is defined as meaningless, then the conditions are also meaningless. The statute allows verification.
If you take the ambiguity that I just raised, do you think the offer would be meaningless? Wouldn't it be something to which the offeree could raise his hand and say, I accept if by saying it's subject to the terms in force on the day you say that, all it means is whether the payment is due on the first day of the month or the last day of the month, whether the grace period for late payment is 5 days or 7 days. There are all sorts of other terms, or whether instead it means the term is do you get a lot of credit or trivial credit.
Well, the fee can change. It says there may be an annual fee of $15, but I could easily imagine manipulating the fee.
Well, they first of all say actual APR and payments are determined later, and then doesn't satisfy them. They then come back and say actual rates, fees, and terms may be changed at any point.
Was the subject of what the word terms means explored in the discovery in this case?
Will you repeat the question, please?
Was the question what the word terms in that phrase means explored in the discovery in this case? When they say that, what does it mean?
We didn't go into discovery on what the definition of terms by the defendant was. Look to the material terms that were in or missing from the mailer. The trial judge found that it was not a firm offer of credit because the terms were not adequately set forth. So it was explored in the briefing, as I believe it has been explored in the briefing here. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement, but we're not done yet.